Accession number 30277, Reel 5.
Yes.
This is the third reel of a taped interview with Bob Long in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 6th of the 9th, 2007, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Obviously, we've been talking about your time at Leyburn, and you're talking about your being housed in a ranger's quarters. You talk also in your book, Z Special Unit Secret War Operation Seamount 1, about a specific occasion when you all decided that you were going to need specific weapons to take away with you when you did leave. Let's hear that story.
Indeed, yes. There was a shed at the back of the ranger's cottage which housed quite a lot of tools, and in the open there was a grindstone and a small forge. Odd cast rings were around the place, and we got the forge working. I think the air pressure was a foot pedal affair or something like that. And we made what we considered to be something useful for us. Some went for stilettos, some made quite a big parangs, and others made just knives. I made a knife, but
these are out of
old truck springs. Yes. But unfortunately, the tempering didn't work out correctly, and mine, I don't know about the others, but mine had pieces broke out of it when I used it, so it was far too brittle. But the intention was there to arm ourselves with something that we considered we might need during the operation. Yes.
Some of those other stories that you were telling me before, there was a chap who had been sort of big-noting himself.
Yes, well, we were having, seeing there was 10 men there, we were having trouble with the toilet, and the one in charge there, who was probably Doug Bauer, he was a senior NCO, requested some tools. We were sent the tools, but we couldn't get anything going on the ground there. It was rock hard. So some engineer unit sent us a machine, a compressor machine with all the necessary tools, but none of us knew how to get the thing started. So then we requested an engineer be sent to us, and an engineer arrived in the form of a fella named Maddox, resplendent in his ribbons and wings and sergeant stripes, we thought, well, you know, surely you'll get it going, but he didn't get it going the first day. The next day we were off to Warwick to shop around for something to treat the skin that we had, the kangaroo skin. And during the time there,
This was a kangaroo that you'd shot?
That was a kangaroo that I had shot, yes. We knew there were two security men constantly hovering around us if we went away from the cottage. And they were there, looking very ordinary, and one of them was apparently listening to this engineer sergeant, and he was blowing his trumpet to a girl in a bar made in one of the hotels. And the next thing, we of course had the two different, two or three different ways, manners in which he got his DCM and got his wings. One was in Crete and one was in Greece, he'd told different members. And then after this, the security man stepped in, and he was sort of under arrest. And Wally Pear and I, the other wireless operator, had to take him to Brisbane under arrest. We were armed and with submachine guns, and they were loaded. We delivered him there, and we heard later that he'd flushed his wings and his ribbons all down the toilet to get rid of them. What happened to him, we never knew. Of course, we went back to Leyburn and on with the job. But we had two practice jumps there. I'm not too sure whether I mentioned that to acquaint us with the slide and the camera hatch of the B-24.
It was from Leyburn that you were to go to Darwin, I understand.
Exactly, yes. The advance party under Major Tom Harrison took off, and we were supposed to hear from them within a week. We didn't hear from them, and Major Carter, after 10 days, he said, I think we better go. So we flew to Darwin, spent the night there. The two wireless operators, Wally Pear and myself, were taken to Leania radio station to show us the equipment and the staff that they had there, listening for anything that came across the air from any of the parties. And it was very impressive. A lot of army girls there, all with listening posts. The next day we flew to Moratai, and there again Wally Pear and I spent the night with the Moratai wireless operators of our unit. Next morning, another thing that I forgot to mention, at takeoff, us parachutists had to stand on the catwalk of the bomb bays, all huddled up together. This gave the plane some balance. Taking off from Moratai, I thought the thing was never going to fly because it seemed to go for miles and miles before it finally got in the air. We flew over Leyte Gulf. There was a lot of funnels and mast sticking out of the water from Japanese and American ships from obviously a big battle that had gone on there. We landed at San Jose on Mindoro Island. Just missed by a few hours a visit from a Japanese bomber that put a hole in the side of the strip. We were only there for part of a day, an afternoon, and during that afternoon Major Carter came to Wally and I with a message and said, could we make anything out of it at all? There was nothing. It was just a jumble of unassociated words right throughout, excepting one small passage that said, not come in. So Major Carter called us together and he said that he rather suspected that the advance party had been captured, were working under duress or on the run, and he intended dropping in the following morning, and anybody who wanted out could do so, and would be no reference on their war record about it.
Let's talk about you leaving Darwin to go to Moratai. Obviously, this is it. You're heading off overseas. This is an operational duty.
Mm.
What were the feelings that you were experiencing at that stage?
I think we were We were young, excited, and quite confident, even though we had sort of probably speculated, as I did, that we had 50-50 chance of carrying out our duties and coming back again. But there was, at that stage, there was no hesitation. It was all a big, exciting adventure.
Had you been given any further briefings? Had you been
given any further understanding
to your mission?
No, nothing more.
So when you were given this opportunity to pull out if you wish,
nobody,
what was the general feeling?
Nobody thought of pulling out, I don't think. I certainly didn't. And we were all in it.
What were you being told to do if taken prisoner?
Well, that was the next thing, of course. Following Major Carter's advice on the fact that he was going to drop in, anybody could who wanted out could drop out. He issued us all with our cyanide tablet at that stage of the game. Following that, it was early evening, and a padre appeared. We had a small service in an army tent with a pressure lantern. It was interesting, and I've often thought of it, because we had Church of England, Roman Catholic, Methodist, Muslims, all in the one little tent, eight of us, and all no friction whatsoever, of course. And it was very brief, and then we were off at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Had you been given any instruction? Here you've got this cyanide tablet. Now, presumably there's only one reason that you've got a cyanide tablet.
There's only one reason for a cyanide tablet. You could put it, quite safely put it in your mouth, because it was covered with latex, providing you didn't bite it, of course, and that would be the end if you bit it. There was no further instruction. It was just wait and see, more or less, and we took off at 3 o'clock in the morning. We all had our parachutes on. We all crammed along the catwalk of the bomb bays for takeoff, and then after they were established in the air, we could get out and join the other crew. Having our parachute on, of course, I found somewhere to rest and went to sleep. Woke up again, and it was just dawn, and we were flying past Mount Kinabalu, which, according to the charts, was 9,000 odd feet. And we were flying at 10,000. And it was going up and up and up beyond the clouds and further. Later it was established that it was 13,000 odd feet. So it would have been a danger to any air crews if the cloud had been, you know, full cloud cover. We travelled a bit further into Sarawak there were some torpedoes dropped there where the Seamut 1, the Seamut operation was supposed to operate from. At that stage, it was still just Seamut, the Operation Seamut, not 1, 2 and 3. And then we circled around and came back over Barrio, where we were to drop in. I understand that the lead plane, which would have been Toby Carter's plane, was flying. We were all flying at 3,000 feet because there was too much cloud to come any lower. And Toby Carter his plane must have recognised something on the ground, because information came back that they were dropping, and they did. By the time we got over the same area, there was full cloud cover below us. We dropped out. Bill Sosham, Abu Qasim, myself, Don Horsnell, and the Bren gun. We were supposed to drop out in 6 seconds. Apparently, it was safe to throttle the plane's inboard engines back for that amount of time to 135 miles an hour. But I understand it took 9 seconds for us to go out, probably because the crew had to manhandle the Bren gun last of all, not sending it down too soon so they would have hit somebody on the head with it, and that was probably the delay.
Let's go back a bit. You're fully equipped, and what did that equipment entail?
Different for different people, actually. Wireless operators, we're all equipped with a set of oversized overalls which have been cut off at the knee and the elbows, and this was to stop any bumps and revolvers and grenades and anything else getting caught on the way out through the camera hatch, which was, I suppose, only about 2 foot by 3 foot at the outside. The wireless operators, I had a lot of crystals. The big one-time pad dictionary, lots of message pads, and the transcription pads for the one-time pad, which of course bloated me out somewhat considerably. Water bottle, and a pistol, and that was mine. Some of the others carried a Sten gun or Austin down in front of them, underneath the overalls, and some had hand grenades also, but we had enough to just get our signal gear through the hole in the back of the plane, as you might say. So that was all we had. And hopefully we could get armed when we got down there. When I got out, I looked for Abu Qasim. I couldn't see him. And I looked back to see if Don Horsnell was out. I didn't see him or the Bren gun. But I noticed down below, just about to go through the cloud, one parachutist with his parachute in tatters, and I knew that had to be Bill Sosham. He was a 16-stone man and easily the heaviest of us all. And I thought, I wrote Bill off immediately, of course, but he survived landing in a swamp up to his knees in mud. And, of course, as Bill says in one of his dialogues, there was a few fruity messages went through because they gave us these parachutes that had already done 100 jumps and had been pensioned off, knowing they wouldn't get them back. But that was the last of the pensioned off parachutes. After that, everybody got a nice new one. Nylon, American nylon parachutes. But
it's another story, and it'd be good to talk about that. But here you are, you're heading out, and had the training served you well? Here you are, you're on your operation.
Yes.
One thing to be jumping out in the training session, but one thing, presumably, heavy laden, to be jumping into the unknown, virtually.
Yes, but I think from memory, I'm sure that the all the instruction that we'd had served us well. After I went through the clouds and came out the other side, I could see what looked like, there was a river there. There was a longhouse, there was a river, and there was this paddock that looked like it had black stumps in it. And I didn't want to tangle with black stumps. So I pulled on the rigging lines, and I didn't want to land in the river either. I pulled on the rigging lines to slip to the left. And eventually I landed on the shore of the river as I sort of aimed for. The black stumps weren't stumps at all. They were clumps of rushes, very dark green, and of course from high up they looked like they were black stumps. Yeah, there was quite a gathering of locals to greet us and shake hands and help with anything that they could.
Had you been told anything at this stage about the purpose of your mission?
Yes, I suppose we had been filled in sort of briefly that it was mainly to collect information. At that stage, it was collecting information, wirelessing it back to Darwin. Yes, and that is what happened in the main.
Presumably, you would be being dropped into a fairly safe zone if you've got locals coming out to greet you.
Yes, yes.
What were you told about the general situation of the Japanese at this time in Borneo?
They weren't sure just how far the Japanese had penetrated inland, and where we dropped in, there hadn't been very much contact with them, if anything at all. Further towards the coast, this is of course from any direction at least 100 miles in from the coast, probably a bit further. The Japanese hadn't bothered to penetrate that far in, although they had teams of workers under a few Japanese who came in to collect rice and fruit and anything else that they could steal from the local population. Fairly safe. If you can be safe 1,000 miles in enemy territory, it's just safe if they're not determined to come and get you. And if they had been determined to come and get us, we'd have been on the run, no doubt.
Well, presumably too, if the locals hadn't already been won over by the Japanese, it would be a safe area.
Oh, yes. Well, our original approach was going to be by water, by submarine, and that would have been far more hazardous because the coastal people had been subjected to Japanese authority for a number of years, and they would have been very, very difficult to win over onto our side, and there would have been no doubt at all there would have been people who would have sold us out, as it happened with other parties. We never had any of that problem, actually. Mm. Not to my knowledge.
Presumably too that you would be given orders on how to collect yourselves once you had landed. What was it like to land and to then get your group together?
That was the pretty difficult part, actually. I was not far from the longhouse, and by the time I got near the longhouse, Major Carter was there, and Tay Soon Hin was there. And he said, "Will you fellas go and see if you can find some of our torpedoes, because they were scattered hell west and crooked, and a lot of them were never ever found." So we went straight away out searching through some of the low scrub, but didn't find anything. And by the time I got back to the longhouse, it would have been mid to late afternoon. Major Carter approached me and said, "Would I stay behind with the advance party and see if I could sort out their radio problems?" Which I agreed to, and he said, "You can catch us up at a later date when they get further wireless operators in." But of course, that never happened. And that at that time, it was starting to disintegrate, as you might say, into SEMUT 1 and SEMUT 2 and ultimately SEMUT 3. And even after the end of the war, there was a SEMUT 4. So they were splitting.
We should make a note here, too, of the date. You'd parachuted safely, and you give the date at April 16th, 1945.
Yes, yes, yes.
Let's talk about your duties on landing.
On landing, as I say, Major Carter asked me. I said yes, I'd stay behind and work it out. So it was only a matter of a few minutes, half an hour or something like that. I didn't see any of the others from my drop. They were busy looking for store chutes, of course, torpedoes, and they gave me two of the local boys, young fellas, and they guided me up the side of this very muddy, leech-infested mountain to a tiniest little shelter where the radio was, and a jungle hammock for me to sleep in. I sent a message through that night and just waited to see whether, you know, everything was satisfactory. One of the problems, of course, is the code is you've got to be accurate. You know, if you subtract wrongly by one digit, it can mean the difference between send us some more ammunition and evacuate us immediately. Just one digit can make that much difference. So you have to be accurate. As it happened, it was received all right, decoded correctly, and we had no further problems for the whole of the time that we were there. I didn't stay there very long. It was only about two or three nights, I think, perhaps a week at the outside, that I was up on that terribly muddy jungle, leech-infested area, side of a mountain. And the next thing, I got a note from Tom Harrison telling me to get a party together of locals and get all the gear and go south. About a day's march south to another village of Parmain, where there was a site on the top of a very almost completely upright. You had to go up a ladder sort of thing cut in the side of the hill to get to the top of it, but it was a wonderful location for a radio. Yeah, terrific.
What were some of the, you don't have to go into too much detail, but what were some of the messages that you were hearing? What were you actually receiving on your radio time?